I'm Gene Kansas. You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. We cover the arts, architecture, design, development, city planning, preservation. Today's show, hydrodynamic.
When we started in 1994, just a few years before the Olympics, it was well known and had been for decades that every time it rained just a little bit, raw sewage would flow out of sewer pipes into creeks and into the river. Material that you're used to seeing in bathrooms and toilets would be in creeks in city parks.
When I look at water, what do I see? I see most living things. I see how I feel most of the day, that I'm this vessel of liquid that's trying to figure itself out, that's always changing shape. The beauty of water is that it literally adheres to any shape it's in.
As an architect, water is the one thing that you want to make sure you keep out of the building. You know, so you spend a lot of time understanding where water's coming from and where it wants to go. And if you don't understand that, if you don't understand the lay of the land that you're working on, you're always going to have problems because land's not flat. It's going to try and flow somewhere, and you have to understand where it naturally wants to go. And generally, you don't want to fight it any more than you have to.
That's right. That's right. It is. Yeah. It's going to find the bottoms of things. It's going to find the sides, all the cracks. It's going to find the lid, the rim.
If you think about it, it's at the bottom of a valley. And there are like over 900 acres that drain into that valley. And under the ground there is a lot of groundwater. In fact, the lake at the old Fourth Ward Park is dug deep enough so that it hits the groundwater and is fed from below. So that lake is filled from below by actually the water that's kind of the Pond Springs water. So it's actually kind of there in that lake.
You know, the thing that probably makes this more unique than anything else is, you know, we're not just solving a stormwater issue. And this was adaptive use of a different kind, of a different scale when you're looking at not just how that might impact, you know, one particular building owner or a group of people, but something that could, you know, impact an entire neighborhood.
My guests today are Sally Bethay, Executive Director and Founder of the Upper Chattahoochee River Keeper.
I never knew. To save a river, you've got to learn a lot about sewers and laws and community organizing, getting people to understand what the real issues are. And it's not just about water pollution, it's about having enough water. It's about, particularly in Atlanta, with the droughts we've had, the fact that we are located real high up in a river basin where our watershed is very small. We've got a little tiny river out there trying to supply 3.5 million people with drinking water. So we've got to be efficient, not only not contaminate our waterway, but be very efficient and careful in our use.
Markham Smith, principal at Smith Dahlia Architects and one of the founders of the historic Fourth Ward Park.
I don't really think about sustainability so much, or certainly not entirely in terms of buildings. I think equally as important when you talk about sustainability, you have to think about how does this sustain the places that I live, and how does this sustain the quality of the neighborhood and the world that I'm going to be in. You know, is what I'm going to do make this place more complete? Does it give it something that it's missing?
Former divorce attorney turned author turned Atlanta historian Sharon Foster Jones.
There's some controversy about where the springs actually were. A spring is a spot where water naturally springs forth from the ground, of course. And that spot, it seems to, from a historian's point of view, from looking at old maps, from reading old descriptions, it was at the bottom of the railroad embankment. And it came out from rocks, and there were two springs, and they were 6 inches apart.
And the founder and dance maker at Glow ATL, Laurie Stallings.
Now, it's not based on can you keep the line. It's just based on being able to recognize a line, a beginning and an end point. What happens in between those two points is the artist's dialogue with himself and the community he lives in and the rest of the world.
I was born in Macon, Georgia. They kept my daddy in the American jail. He told me, if you keep your hands clean, yeah, you won't hear them bloodhounds on your trail. Well, I fell in
land, oh, up in Tennessee. They called me way up in Nashville. They locked me up and threw away the key. What'd you do, son? I washed my hands in muddy water. Washed my hand, oh, but it didn't come clean. Tried to do like my daddy told me, yeah. But I must have washed my hands in a muddy stream.
We've all heard that April showers bring May flowers. In this month's episode of Sidewalk Radio, we'll also find that water brings folklore, inspiration, public parks, and preservation. And with these grand ambitions in mind, we begin humbly at a wet spot in North Georgia that marks the beginning of Atlanta's greatest aquatic landmark, the Chattahoochee River.
It's a tiny wet spot on the side of a mountain. I love going there. It's a little spring. All rivers start with a little spring somewhere and then become larger as they're fed by tributaries. And the last time I was there during a drought, it was not much more than a damp spot. But pretty cool to start such a mighty river that flows 546 miles downstream to the Gulf of Mexico at Apalachicola. And along the way provides so much drinking water,
recreation,
hydropower, irrigation,
wildlife habitat,
all those things. I think I had long wanted to work in a field where I could help give a voice to the voiceless natural resources. And water was always something that entranced me. I grew up on a little tributary that flows to Nancy Creek, to Peachtree Creek, to the Chattahoochee River. And when you see that people, for whatever reason, are carelessly polluting the waterways that belong to all of us, or elected officials are making very poor decisions that are not only bad for the environment but bad for taxpayers, it just makes you mad and you decide, you know, you can't stand it anymore. And there were a whole group of us who felt that way, but it was pretty daunting because we filed our litigation against Atlanta the year before the Olympics came, the Summer Olympics in 96, and we were a little very unknown organization, but we had the Federal Clean Water Act behind us, which allows citizen groups to go to court if federal or if regulatory agencies aren't doing their job. And so we had the smoking gun evidence, and we went into court. We've made amazing amount of progress. Close to $2 billion has been spent on fixing our plumbing, and we're seeing measurable results, improvements in the river and in streams. There certainly many other issues with an urban river like the Chattahoochee, and we still have plenty of work to do, but we're very pleased with the progress we've seen in the last 18 years.
As far as like the actual, the rights for waters, we're different for how we treat our water rights than other parts of the country. Can you explain that?
Well, the legal system west of the Mississippi is different than east of the Mississippi. Here and in Georgia, we have a regulated riparian system, which means that anyone who has land abutting a waterway has a right to reasonable use of that water as long as that use does not impinge downstream users significantly. Out west, it's called prior appropriation, sort of first in line, first in time. And there are rivers out there that are over-allocated, that there people have rights to all of the water down to the bare bones. Thankfully, we don't have that system in the East.
So, like, if you have, let's say, some type of mill that, you know, requires water in the West, you can take as much, divert as much as you want for your use. Don't worry about the neighbors downstream.
If you have legal rights that you and I'm not sure the legal mechanisms that they use, but if you have gone to the state and have said, I'm taking this much water out, and that much water is still left, no one got there before you, then yes, you can do that without having to take into consideration the way we do here downstream users. Right. It is a permitting system, so if you want to pull water out for a mill, for instance, in Georgia, you go to the Georgia EPD, and they evaluate your request. The good news with the improvement to the city of Atlanta's plumbing, as both Mayor Franklin and Mayor Reed have said, is that now some their number is $18 billion of in-town investment has been made, which on the backs of being able to bring clean water into new developments and projects and take away the wastewater. It's just a critical function that too many people have just ignored through the 70s and 80s and into the early 90s.
Give a little time, won't you drink a little wine? In the meantime, wait and be patient while you find dirty water. Dirty water. It's only dirty water and it's gonna run for you someday.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, Hydrodynamic, brought to you by Perkins & Will. On this search for water in Atlanta's physical and cultural narrative, we cannot ignore one of the great explorers of history whose name still dominates the Atlanta cityscape. That, of course, is Ponce de Leon.
It was named by a guy named Henry Lumpkin, and he was a doctor. Later, he was in real estate, but early on, he was a doctor, and he named it after the famous Ponce de Leon and the Fountain of Youth because of the healing qualities that everyone believed it had.
Well, one of the funny things about the Ponce de Leon Springs, of course, is that Ponce de Leon himself was never here. The group that was there was a group of railroad workers, of course, Atlanta's reason for being.
A couple years after the Civil War, the railroad was being built across where it is now, where the Beltline is. And the workers who were building the railroad found the springs. And they were kind of, they're near where the Sears building is now. And they began drinking the water. And
Sears building being City Hall East turn Pont City Market.
Yes, depending on your age or how long you've been in Atlanta. And they found the springs, and they started drinking from them. And a couple weeks later, everybody was feeling great. There had been a kind of a sickness going on in the camp, and they got better. So they thought that they were healing springs. They had a terrible taste, and so they thought that that made them better. Yeah, apparently they were mineral springs. And that whole area is very interesting to me. In the 1800s, it was kind of a place where people would come out from the city and picnic for the day. But then by the early 1900s, it was a real park. It was an amusement park with rides.
What was it called?
It was just called Ponce de Leon Park. And across the street where like the Home Depot shopping center is, was part of it. And all of that was a lake.
So how do you go from like a lake to a Home Depot?
It was a man-made lake to begin with. They made it in 1890. And then Georgia Power, the predecessor to Georgia Power, built the Atlanta Crackers Stadium there. And they drained that lake in 1907 and put the Crackers Stadium there. But really, by the early 1920s, no one went to the Ponce de Leon Park anymore. And then Sears bought it and built it in 1926, built the building in 1926.
It is interesting to consider how all of this history is quite literally bubbling up into the modern city in the form of the historic Fourth Ward Park. The name itself is a tad misleading, as the park is by no means historic, having officially opened in 2011. Nor is it really a park, or at least not strictly so. The park is, in reality, or at least in an emergency situation, an above-ground stormwater detention pond to contain the overflow of frequent flooding in the area.
I mean, most of that area was low-rise industrial buildings, you know, one, maybe a few two-story buildings scattered in there, a lot of just open either parking areas for trucks or just fallow land that had been used for dumping. Actually, there was one of the properties that was essentially a dump site. And, you know, the story of how it went from, you know, what it was to what it is it's a long story.
Well, let's start with why it was necessary. What was the problem with the water? And then what was the solution from both like a practical standpoint and a design standpoint?
Okay. Stormwater was the precipitating catalyst that moved this idea along, and it's also the It's the thing that got a group together initially to really talk about what the potential of this area was. This fellow by the name of Bill Eisenhower, a local engineer who had been very interested in this issue for some years prior to when we got together, and had been working on trying to convince the city that there were better ways than tunnels for dealing with the stormwater.
Would it flood? I mean, was that part of the problem?
Absolutely. I mean, we all, well, a lot of us can remember the way Piedmont Park used to look in a big storm. Our existing historic system, because so many things have been paved over, the ground didn't percolate. You know, the water doesn't flow the way it used to flow. That the sewers couldn't handle the capacity of water that would go into them in a major storm, and so that water is going to come out on the surface. And when it comes out on the surface, it's going to puddle somewhere. Eventually, it's going to get dammed. And what eventually would happen in this area in a big storm, you know, like the photograph we were looking at before, is that you would get several feet of water at the lowest level of the City Hall East property.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at that picture now, and I mean, there's cars halfway underwater.
And there were really only two solutions to that were, you know, that made any sense, that were proposed. One was the solution that the city was getting ready to move forward with, which they've used in other parts of the city, and that was to build a large tunnel underneath North Avenue, run it up North Avenue to Charles Allen, down Charles Allen into the park, and eventually connect into the treatment plant there at the end of Piedmont Park. And, you know, that's a viable solution and a very expensive one. And Bill's idea was that, hey, let's make an amenity out of this. You know, this is a better idea. This is a better idea than building a tunnel. And it's going to save us a whole bunch of money. You know, I mean, they saved, you know, estimates from, you know, $20 to $40 million by doing this and having a park than building the tunnels. You know, so we not only got to, you know, solve the stormwater issue, you know, we were able to, you know, get, you know, this green space out of it.
Tell people, describe, like, from, you know, top to bottom, what this park looks like so they can get an idea.
It's one of the most incredible things of its kind in an urban area. I mean, the fact that it got done and that it's done as well as it is, it's something that people ought to come and see. I mean, because this is, you know, normally these type of things are just, you know, chain link fenced off.
I mean, when you
they're overgrown puddles.
Right. You say stormwater amenity, and I'm looking out there and it's like, this is a lake.
It is. I mean, it's a lake, and it has, you know, from the upper level of the tops of the retaining wall on the southwest side, you know, down to the lake level, it's probably 25, 30 feet. I mean, it's a major land formation. The surface area of the constant pond is, I think it's about 2 acres, and it could increase to as much as like 4 or 4.5 acres in a major storm. And you know, and it's designed actually so that, you know, as the water rises, it can come over the sidewalks that are there at the edge of the established pool, and you know, the landscaping is all designed to be water tolerant, you know, for short periods of time. And, you know, I go there and I go by there and I see the people using it. I mean, it's just great to see, mothers and kids and dads and folks out there. You know, they have a place to go now, a place that's not threatening, that's beautiful, and that, you know, the one thing about the park is that, you know, there's just a great story there. I mean, whether you're talking about water and what, you know, where this water's coming from and where it's going to, or you're talking about the history of that area. I mean, this is old Fourth Ward. You know, in the 50s was a thriving neighborhood. I want to say it had, you know, something like 20 or 30,000 people living in the old Fourth Ward. You know, by the 90s, it had like 7,000 people. It had the highest rate of childhood poverty in the city, the heaviest concentration of Section 8 housing in the southeast, and it had half the per capita green space as the rest of the city. And that's what places like this do. I mean, they're allowing the neighborhood to densify. You get more people there. I mean, it's giving people a place to, you know, to have some interface with nature and with water, you know, knowing where it comes from and where it goes.
We're going to conclude today's exploration with The Search for the Exceptional, a a collaborative project by Glow ATL with filmmaker Micah Stanzel. This performance plays on the role of water in one unlikely front in the civil rights struggle, the desegregation of Atlanta's public pools. The performance is set at the geographic dividing line of Atlanta's historically white and black neighborhoods, which also just happens to be up the hill from the historic Fourth Ward Park. Rather than a pool, they'll be using the cavity of a recently built skate park, and rather than water, they'll be filling it with that thing
I called universal gesture, contemporary dance. Glow is a contemporary performance platform. Performance meaning that it's live, it's happening in front of you, it's a human experience.
High and dry in the long hot day.
And I use contemporary dance as my conduit.
Lost and lonely every way. Got flats all around, sky up above. Yes, I need a little water of love.
I began by researching music of 1962 and 63 because ultimately this work is a response to that time. 62, 63, when public recreation centers in our city desegregated.
Why a pool? Mm-hmm.
Why a pool? Because a couple of reasons. One is because the pools were the most blatant pictorial view of desegregation. Folks that were not of colored skin decided to go build their own pool or move further away from the city or suddenly make the pool that was a community pool suddenly private. Our city itself suddenly was short of funds to keep these pools open. Some of them literally closed the next day. Others were filled with cement. The pools were just extremely blatant, the response to desegregation.
And you're within liquid, literally.
That's right. At that time, there was all this, to be frank with you, great usage of propaganda and discussion of, yes, viruses. And there's something to be said about bathing together. I mean, that truly is an intimate experience. You put that with the fact that for the first time, women were out in public with a large portion of their flesh being exposed. Well, that's huge. And people just weren't ready to handle it. And frankly, people still aren't ready to handle it today.
In your pool for this performance, mm-hmm. are the dancers the bathers, or are they the water, or are they both, or what?
They're both, yeah. You know, what's fascinating with this work is because we weren't able to get our pool, literal pool, we did better than that. What began as the search for an empty pool, public pool, ended up in a rather fantastical space, which is not literally used as a pool every day, but it has the shape of a pool. It's the new skate park. And it's just outrageous because what you have with the skate park is an organism of vessels rather than one big vessel. You have a sense of ebb and flow. Culture is just identifying and being able to encapsulate daily life through the art forms and can ultimately be extremely profound in our city, that culture indeed has a place in daily life.
I'd like to thank my guests today, Sally Bethay, Markham Smith, Sharon Foster Jones, and Laurie Stallings. Of course, I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Perkins & Will, ideas and buildings that honor the broader goals of society. You've been listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. We'll see you next month.